on air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Coming up today, a passion for soil on this World Soil Day.
Soil itself is alive, and there's a lot of life in soil. I guess it's demonstrating that soil is dynamic and alive, and we need to take care of it, essentially. It's an extremely precious resource.
And memories of the 1967 bushfires and the role of the Country Hour.
Farmers on the northwest coast from Smithton to Scottsdale generously donated over 200,000 bales of hay to the farmers in the south that were burnt out following those bushfires.
A retired farmer who just happens to be 80 years old talks about the role the Country Hour played in the 67 fires in Tasmania. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you. And what's been a big week for the program and for the ABC, also it's World Soil Day. And as every farmer knows, the soil is so important, very much the centre of everything they do. We'll hear from a passionate soil lover a little bit later in the program. Also coming up today, the latest from TAS Networks with the Northwest Transmission Development and expectations for the start of work on the project and where the workers might be housed. The stud merino breeders have their annual sale today at Campbelltown. And talking livestock, Richard Bailey will be along to check the latest on the markets both here and on the mainland. We will have a detailed look at the weather in around about 10 minutes from now. And the text line is there for you to stay in touch, 0438 922936. Tom from Mienna has used the text line to ask if there's any update on the power outage at Mienna. I've heard that it could be out for quite some time. Tom, I spoke to TAS Networks about 10 minutes ago before we went to air, and they think it's something to do with the bushfire situation up there, and that power lines obviously have been affected, and they are still yet unable to go to that particular area where there is a problem with the power line. So, yeah, it might be quite some time. Talking about the Tasmanian fires, the latest we have is the bushfire in Dolphin Sands and surrounding areas has a Watch and Act warning and is still not safe to return. Now, if you did not leave the area overnight, continue to monitor conditions and be alert for any changes. If you have left the area, please do not return yet. It is not safe to return. Dolphin Sands Road is closed. Conditions are expected to be changeable. An evacuation centre is open at Swansea Town Hall in Franklin Street, Swansea. And the Watch and Act warning for Glen Lusk has been downgraded to advice. Return with caution there. So just repeating, the bushfire in Dolphin Sands and surrounding areas still at Watch and Act level, not safe to return. The bushfire in Glen Lusk has been downgraded to advice level. Return with caution. If you want more information, go to the TAS Alerts app or website. And of course, stay tuned to ABC Local Radio. Well, the Tasmanian salmon industry is talking up the early results of tests on wild fish and the environment around pens of salmon treated with the antibiotic fluorphenicol. The antibiotic was approved by the Australian Veterinary Medicines Authority to treat the disease rickettsia. Some people have been concerned about what impact the antibiotics will have on the broader environment outside the pens. While the results have not been released publicly, the industry says data so far shows there's minimal impact on wild fish caught.
The sampling starts at the pen boundary and moves out to 3 kilometres. And so we have samples that are taken right up at the pen, right out to about 3 kilometres. And we're sampling a range of things. We're sampling the fluorphenicol concentration in water, we're sampling fluorphenicol concentration in sediments, and we're also sampling the fluorphenicol concentration in wild fish that we catch.
And what are the time intervals for those samples?
So we start the sampling, a baseline sample happens before the first treatment. Then we'd sample during the treatment. The treatments take 10 days. And then we sample one day after the treatment's finished, again at 7, and then continuing out until 21 days.
And where did you find traces of fluorphenicol?
So, and the good news here is that fluorphenicol concentrations in the water column are extremely low. We're talking in the millionths of a gram per litre, grains of salt in an Olympic swimming pool. The concentrations of fluorphenicol in the sediments, we have not detected in over 100 samples of sediments any fluorphenicol in the sediments associated with these treatments. And in wild fish, so far we've analysed 288 fish that we have caught, including flathead, Australian salmon and wrasse, And in those 288 fish, 286 returned no fluorphenicol at the level of reporting, and one had a very negligible trace and one had a trace.
At what time interval did you get the traces of fluorphenicol?
So they were both, we've been sampling at the time when we'd most expect to see fluorphenicol in the environment, and that is during and immediately after the treatment.
What about lobsters? There's been a lot of concern about lobster fishing.
So the program that we're rolling out is the one that has been provided to us by the EPA and Public Health. And so that program is designed to determine whether there's any impact on environmental health and public health. That program focuses on sediments, water column, and the fish that you would recreationally catch. The work that's being done around crayfish is a matter for the department to speak to.
How much antibiotics was used in the end?
So the antibiotics that we use are on prescribed by veterinarians, and the dosage is prescribed through the federal regulator. And so remember, we have millions of fish that we are treating at a time, potentially, or hundreds of thousands. So in the first three treatments, there's been about 700 kilograms of antibiotic used.
So no more than that?
In the treatments to date.
And what treatments are planned now?
So today, Tassal has announced that it is going to be treating one of its some pens on one of its leases at Soldiers Point, and that is that'll be the fourth treatment following the three that have already occurred. What I'll say about this is that the treatments are done on veterinary advice, so they have to be prescribed by a veterinarian. And they'll do it even when it's required, based on clinical signs.
Do you know what whether the government will change its advice around where recreational fishers should fish near when fluorphenicol is being used?
So the program that we're delivering is under the supervision. It was designed by the EPA and Public Health. All of the data, it's collected by independent third parties. It's the Tasmanian government's laboratory that does the testing, and that data all feeds into the EPA and Public Health. They will have all of that data, and I'm sure they'll be analysing and considering their advice.
Can we get a copy of this study?
The EPA will publish all of the data and the study results at its completion.
Do you see that people might be a little bit cynical about results when they can't be, when we can't have a look at them independently, that they're put forth by the salmon industry?
So the program is designed by the EPA. The monitoring is done by independent third-party contractors. The analysis is done by AST. The data goes to the EPA and Public Health. We get to see the data on the way through, and we think it's important to describe the data early because of those concerns that people in the community have. It'll be up to the EPA and Public Health to frame their advice around the data that they have, and that is really a question for them.
So we can't get any results via the salmon farms, even though you've seen them?
So I've told you the results. I've told you that there is no detectable trace in sediments. I've told you that we've sampled 288 fish, 286 returned no fluorphenicol. And I've also said that we had very low concentrations in the millionths of a gram per litre of fluorphenicol in the water column during treatment, but it very quickly goes away to non-detectable.
That's Salmon Tasmania CEO John Whittington ending that report from Fiona Breen on the early results for the testing of fluorphenicol in southern waters. The EPA says it does not yet have a full set of monitoring results, and it wants to make sure all the data undergoes rigorous scientific analysis before the results are released. TAS Networks is confident of an early start to work on the Northwest Transmission development next year, despite threatened legal action from farmers disaffected with the revamp of transmission lines. Project Director Richie Sheather says negotiations are continuing with landholders in Tasmania's Northwest to get the project underway.
Had fantastic support really so far from the community and landowners along the route. As of at the moment, we have access to about 87% of the route. And we've been able to get on and work with farmers with over 96% of the route in terms of ensuring that we can do the work necessary around geotech and surveying to ensure that we can begin the project early next year.
Have you extended the deadline at all for those farmers who didn't sign?
So, as you mentioned, the deadline did expire on Monday. So we are working as hard as we can, and we continue to encourage landowners to work with us. We have four land engagement coordinators that have been working for 5 or 6 years up in that region with landowners to try and get the best available outcome for both the project and landowners. And that has meant that a considerable amount of work has been done in terms of where we locate our infrastructure. So we just really encourage people to continue to talk with us. The strategic benefit payment was just one component of compensation that's available to landowners. So, the landowners are available and our land agents are there to talk with them. So the best way we can get outcomes for everybody is for them to contact us and continue to work with us to get the project underway.
So you're saying they still could get that strategic benefit payment?
I'm not going to get into individual cases or anything like that at this stage. I think landowners deserve and are entitled to confidentiality around how we negotiate and work with them. So all I can say is that we really encourage, at the end of the day, we have over 3,500 kilometres of transmission lines across the state and over 20,000 kilometres of distribution network, which has been housed by landowners for generations. And we understand the role in terms of working with them and keeping their support for this infrastructure, which is vitally important to get electricity from where energy is generated to where it's needed. So we just encourage that people work with us and make sure that we can do the best for both the project and themselves to get a good outcome.
Richie, are you concerned about the threat of legal action?
Well, everybody's entitled to their legal advice. I'm very confident that the work we've done over the last 6 years on this project as a business, we've done our due diligence and the processes that have been followed over the years, a considerable amount of work has been done by the team. But I'm very confident that we will be ready to go early next year.
Yeah, you say early next year. When are you expecting to start construction and how long will it take?
So construction, we're targeting to be underway by the first quarter of next year. So counting down the days very rapidly at the moment with Christmas and amongst all that. But yes, early next year we're looking to start, probably around March, April. And the project will take about three and a half years of construction. We're aiming to be complete by about June 2029. For those that don't know about the project, it's about 130 kilometres of transmission lines that we're upgrading. In terms of that whole line that we talk about from Burnie through to Sheffield through to Palmerston, about 126 kilometres out of the 129 kilometres is upgrading existing transmission lines. So working within the corridor and around the corridor that we already have to replace those existing towers. There's about 400 or so towers along that route. We're now going to replace those with larger new towers and reduce that number down to about 300 towers. So about a 25% reduction in the number of towers along the route. There's about 3 kilometres of new transmission lines, so 3K out of the 129, from Heybridge, where Marinus bring the cable onshore, through to where we need to connect into the Burnie-Sheffield line.
Where are you going to house all the workers?
So the workers will be predominantly up in the north. We've had a lot of feedback on the community around how they should be housed. Obviously, there was concern about a number of workers coming in and taking up rental properties and things like that. So we've been very conscious of that. We also have to think about their safety and distances that they need to travel for this. We're trying to keep that to under an hour. So the contractor that we have, Genus, who will be coming in to do the bulk of the work, have found a location, the Discovery Holiday Park up in East Devonport, where predominantly the bulk of the workers will be housed.
Project Director for the Northwest Transmission Development, Richie Sheather, looking at housing for workers on the project and the timeframe for work to commence early in the new year despite threatened legal action. Okay, time to check the latest on the weather. Alex Militsis joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Alex.
G'day, Tony.
Any rainfall of note anywhere?
No, it's been pretty dry for the last couple of days, Tony.
Yeah, windy as well, but that's dropped off markedly. What's happening out there at the moment?
Yeah, well, generally it's a pretty fine day. No rainfall around the place. Some high cloud coming in from the west, but look, kind of mild right now. Some wispy high cirrus across the state. And the highest temperatures were reported so far or observed today so far has been at Eddiston Point, Larapuna in the northeast, which has got up to 21 degrees, followed by 20 degrees at Launceston, Tony. So looking quite nice out there.
And what is in front of us as we head into the weekend?
Yeah, so we've got a big change in the weather on the way. So tomorrow morning starting off quite nice, but we do see a pretty significant cold front reach the west coast late tomorrow morning, and that will gradually cross the state during the afternoon tomorrow, bringing a band of showers to much of the state tomorrow. So we're expecting around 5 to 15 or so millimetres across the west of the state, and maybe 2 to 10 millimetres elsewhere. There could be some isolated totals of sort of above 10 across parts of the remainder of the state tomorrow, but just some moderate rain across the state, and some pretty cold weather returning, particularly from late tomorrow evening. We'll see snow getting down to around 700 metres in the south, and then Sunday is looking like a pretty cool day across much of the state, with temperatures 2 to 5 degrees below average. So a return to some colder weather over the weekend, Tony.
Now, warnings, what have we got?
Yep. So with the weather on the way, we do have a coastal hazard warning out for abnormally high tides. That's across the east coast with the high tide tomorrow morning, and we are seeing the tides just reaching our sort of criteria for that abnormally high tide tomorrow. So there might just be some minor inundation and some minor impacts across the southeast coast tomorrow morning. We have had pretty high tides over the last few days, and we're expecting the highest tide to be tomorrow morning. Also, with the cold weather coming in tomorrow night and over Sunday, we have issued a bushwalkers alert with snow down to around 700 metres from tomorrow evening. And if you're going boating tomorrow, we do have a strong wind warning out for southern coastal waters, well, for all coastal waters except the lower east coast tomorrow, Tony.
And the coastal waters and swell, Alex?
Yes, so if you are going boating tomorrow, we're generally looking at northwesterly winds of around 20 to 30 knots across most of the coast. Those winds will shift west to southwesterly later on in the day as that cold front crosses. We are expecting winds in the east, though, to be a little bit lighter, maybe sitting at around more like 15 to 25 knots for most of the day tomorrow. Swell tomorrow in the west and south, we're looking at a west to southwesterly swell of around 2.5 to 3.5 metres. In the north, a westerly to northwesterly swell to 1 metre, and in the east, the southerly swell to 1 metre. And right now, the Cape Sorrel wave rider buoy in the west is sitting on a significant wave height of around 4.5 metres. That's mostly coming from the west. And Maria Island wave rider buoy is sitting on around 0.5 metre or so, and that's mostly coming from the south, Tony.
Terrific. Thanks, Alex.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Cheers.
Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Now, if you're not a farmer or avid gardener, the topic of soil might sound a bit boring, but given we all eat food grown in it, it's actually pretty important and can be fun to learn about. Lecturer Bianca Daz makes it her mission to do just that, including coaching students to judge soil.
When I left high school in 2007, there was quite a bit of talk about climate change, and I was really interested in understanding what is the big challenge with that. How do we solve the challenges with climate change and make a better future, essentially a healthier future and safe future for us globally? And I ended up going to Lincoln University in Christchurch. Actually, I'm from New Zealand, studying environmental science. I kind of accidentally, I guess, learned about agriculture, because a lot of the environmental challenges in New Zealand are related to agriculture. We had these amazing soil science lecturers and professors, and that enthusiasm and curiosity just really kind of piqued my interest and rubbed off on me. And yeah, I haven't really been able to shake the soil from my clothes since.
For some, it can be a bit of a dry topic though. So how do you now make it interesting and fun for students that you teach?
Well, the fact that soil is not dirt. Dirt is essentially soil that's been misplaced, but soil itself is alive, and there's a lot of life in soil. I guess it's demonstrating that soil is dynamic and alive, and we need to take care of it, essentially. It's an extremely precious resource. And so we combine that sort of theory along with the science and what it means to people more generally. But then we combine that with getting out in the field and going and touching the soil and looking at different soil types and Tasmania is just the perfect place to be learning soil science because of our geology, our extremely diverse geology, that then means that we have all this diverse soil. So, you know, it's the perfect natural laboratory to be studying soil.
Now, listeners might have heard of sheep or cattle judging, but might not be familiar with soil judging. How does that work?
Well, it does sound like you kind of stand around and you just say, that's a good soil. No, that's not a good soil. It's a little bit more to it than that. So it's actually soil description and interpretation. So the soils do stand around a soil pit. Well, they actually get in the soil pit. It'll be quite large, so we can get enough contestants in the pit at once. But they have to look at the soil and the different layers within the soil, down to about 1 meter depth. And they have to describe the different horizons. They have to look at the texture. They have to look at some chemistry data. The structure, which is a really important concept in soil, because we look at essentially what's the architecture of the soil. Is it like quite strong? Like, can you see lots of angles, or is it quite flat and just kind of looks like a sandhill, which has no structure? All those sorts of things are really important for determining how well suited the soil is for different types of agricultural practices. So, for example, is it better suited to pasture, cropping, orchards, or forestry? And then you can start to make recommendations on how to manage that land most sustainably. So we're avoiding things like overworking the soil and losing it to erosion, or, essentially just completely depleting the soil and its resources. We couldn't grow anything there in the future.
You took a team up to northern New South Wales last week to compete. How did they go?
Yes, to Armidale. It was amazing. It was. It's always really great for us as educators, and you know, as researchers, we don't want to just be knowers. We are learners as well. So it's great for us, as well as the students, to see us sort of struggling with, is it this type of rock material that we're looking at as a parent material of the soil? Or, and so a lot of it is a little bit subjective, and every state will have their own way of classifying the soil. So a lot of it is getting tuned into what other people were thinking and how they're seeing the soil. But the students really gain a lot of, it's essentially a type of learning that you can't get at university these days. A lot of the time we are doing quite structured learning that has, you know, you have to be in a classroom, do theory, and then they have a little bit more time to interpret the results and kind of check things over with lots of time, whereas this is a pressurized environment. So the students are under, I would say, good pressure to develop practical skills. That kind of rubs off in a lot of confidence building. Because they have those practical skills, they're then, once they graduate, they're ready to go and engage directly into their new jobs with whoever they're interacting with, whether it's farmers or grower groups or councils. A lot of just really skills them in a different dimension than what they would normally get at university.
How do you like to celebrate World Soil Day?
It's a great event, a great time of the year. Everybody's sort of a bit more festive, but we do organise events annually for World Soil Day. And this Friday we are holding an event where we have a couple of PhD students from the University of Tasmania who are talking about their research. And then we're going to be celebrating those students who went away to the national competition. Before we took them to the national competition, we had our own state competition. So it's really celebrating that state competition and who did well there, because we not only had students, but we had early career soil scientists, so people who are in the profession of looking at soil, and those people were also building their skills. So it's a celebration of both students and professionals in that space.
Yeah, Bianca Das, a lecturer and researcher in soil science at the University of Tasmania, chatting there to Larissa Smith on World Soil Day. Still to come on today's edition of The Country Hour, a touch of nostalgia with some Blue Hills for you, and the livestock markets with Richard Bailey. First up, the news headlines with Meg Whitfield.
Good afternoon, Tony. The AFL says now is the time for the state to unite behind the Tasmania Devils. The AFL made a roof stadium a condition of granting Tasmania the 19th licence to enter the National League. Last night's parliamentary approval of the stadium means the club will enter the league in 2028. Chief Executive Andrew Dillon says it's a historic step. A new study suggests the shingles vaccine may slow the progression of dementia. The Stanford University-led research has found that the two-dose jab not only appeared to lower new dementia diagnoses by 20%, it also helped those who already have the disease. And the Australian Medical Association has warned the increased cost of private health insurance could have an adverse effect on patient care. A report by the association reveals the cost of health cover has increased at a higher rate than inflation and wage growth. AMA President Danielle McMullen says many of the 15 million Australians with private health insurance can no longer afford to maintain their cover. And there'll be more news at 1 o'clock.
International Day of People with Disability recognises the contributions and achievements of over 5.5 million Australians with disability. Check out some of the ABC's great content at abc.net.au/IDPWD.
The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
What we've now got is $300 million, Saddam's Aussie slush fund. John Howard talks about an inquiry. What I'd like to say today in absolutely clear-cut terms, this is a very big scandal.
That's Kevin Rudd when he was the Shadow Foreign Affairs Minister in 2006, talking about what led to maybe the biggest change in the wheat industry, the Australian Wheat Board Oil for Wheat scandal. Hello, I'm Annie Brown, and this year the Country Hour marks 80 years since it first went to air on ABC Radio on December 3rd, 1945. At the heart of the scandal was AWB Limited, which was accused of paying millions of dollars in kickbacks to Saddam Hussein's regime. Here's Matt O'Sullivan reporting on the Country Hour in October 2005.
Grain traders and growers are angry at confirmation that monopoly wheat exporter AWB was involved in corrupt payments during the Oil for Food program in Iraq. The United Nations report has found more than 2,000 companies were involved in making kickback payments to the Iraqi government to secure oil and humanitarian contracts between 1996 and 2003. AWB paid more than $290 million to a Jordanian trucking company, which ended up in the hands of the Iraqi government, a transaction which the UN says should have been questioned. Chris Brooks from grain trading company Brooks Grain says Australia's trade reputation is in tatters.
They've lost 2 million tonne of wheat sales this year just to Iraq. It's fairly indicative of what's to come.
If any politician in Australia can stand up and try and justify to the Australian wheat growers that they should leave the single desk export marketing rights to the publicly listed company of AWB, then after this announcement, then they probably should be dragged out and flogged with a log.
Managing Director of AWB Andrew Lindberg denies any wrongdoing and says the company didn't know it was paying kickbacks to the Iraqi regime.
Perhaps with the wisdom of hindsight, clearly maybe more inquiry should have been made, but it certainly appeared to us reasonable at the time to pay the fees in the knowledge that every contract had the explicit approval of the United Nations.
And the federal government says it has confidence in AWB's ability to continue to negotiate export deals. Trade Minister Mark Vaile says responsibility for checking the contracts under the Oil for Food program lay with the United Nations. He says the government won't be taking any action against AWB, and that time will tell whether future wheat export deals will be affected.
At the time, the scandal was described in dollar terms as the biggest corruption of its kind in Australia's history, and it prompted the Coal Inquiry. The Australian Wheat Board was founded by the government in 1939, and in 1999 it became a private company owned by wheat growers. The company used a single desk system, where growers' produce was pulled together and sold in bulk to international markets. It was the only company allowed to export Australian wheat overseas. After the scandal broke at the AWB AGM in 2006, growers and shareholders turned out in record numbers looking for answers on the future of the company. Edwina Farley filed this report from the meeting.
Flanks of security guards, police and metal detectors made it no ordinary AGM. In fact, the attitude of AWB executives was pretty much behave yourselves or you'll get thrown out. Louise House, grower and shareholder from Western Australia, also made an impassioned plea for debate to consider the successful history of both the single desk and AWB.
I feel very, very strongly that there has been very much a major media beat-up about the AWB, and the single desk supports Australian growers and especially West Australian growers extremely well, and it distresses me greatly that Australians are now doing to themselves what the Americans have tried to do for 65 years and never succeeded.
Brendan Stewart refused to answer many questions during proceedings, pointing to the ongoing coal inquiry as the reason. And the meeting was peppered with a multitude of hushed discussions between Stewart, acting CEO Peter Polson, and legal advisers from law firm Arnold Bloch Leibler. It made for a frustrating meeting for those growers who wanted some answers, and for Jeff Reed from the Shareholders Association, who held 400,000 proxy votes for the meeting, a meeting he described as disappointing.
Disappointed because the problems besetting the company have been recognised, but there's no action plan proposed to restore the company's reputation. Disappointed because Mr. Lindbergh wouldn't turn up and face the music. And disappointed because the board couldn't bring themselves to say sorry. They've messed up and shareholders have lost 30% of the value.
The single desk system was abolished in 2008 and the market deregulated, opening up Australia to foreign wheat export companies. Celebrating 80 years of rural stories on the Country Hour, I'm Annie Brown.
Yeah, the wheat board scandal. Remember that, one of the many stories covered in detail by the Country Hour. Now, during the 80 years of the program in Tasmania, the radio program has played a strong role in emergency broadcasting, such as the bushfires and floods. Back in the bushfires of 1967 in the south of the state, the Country Hour was central to a food relief effort for farmers affected by the devastating fires across the south. Lindley Chopping, a retired farmer, remembers what happened with a huge operation to get hay from the north of the state to the south.
I'm the same age as the Country Hour, so congratulations to the Country Hour. And in 1967, they did a very great service to the rural community of Tasmania following the disastrous bushfires, because farmers on the northwest coast from Smithton to Scottsdale generously donated over 200,000 bales of hay to the farmers in the south that were burnt out following those bushfires. And it was great reporting by the ABC of coordinating, keeping people informed while that whole operation took place. It was a marvellous effort.
Now, Lindley, your dad had some part to play in this happening, didn't he?
Reg Chopping, my father, yes, and he was chairman of the committee. They did travel from the south in to the northwest in an old Chev Bel Air. They called it the Flying Boardroom, and they had public meetings organised by the TFF and TFSNOA in those days, local farmer meetings, explaining the need for the hay and working out how it would be delivered to the rail depots by the farmers and others. And it was carted by the rail to Hobart and unloaded by the prisoners there at the wharf out onto the trucks and into the utes. And it was a magnificent contribution, and it was well received by those hundreds of burnt out farmers. It really was needed, because there wasn't any autumn break in 67, and so the relief operation had to continue from February right through until September. It was a great operation.
How many farmers did they help, Lindley?
Tony, I've got the records here. I'd go back and have a look. It was hundreds of farmers that were registered with their the livestock that they had previously had and how many they were left with, and everybody was rationed to have that hay quota, and they could pick that up as it came down from up north.
Must have been some sort of operation. It must have taken a while to do it too.
Yes, at King's Pier was where the depot for the south was operating from. Each day that was open, supplies became scarce, so the distribution was slower. And then when supplies came more plentiful, the farmers could then get more hay for their stock.
And you're saying all this information was relayed via the Country Hour?
Yes, they did a great part in spreading that information around when meetings were on, how many bales were being delivered, and when it was being made available. The Country Hour and the Mercury did a great job because it was a terrific operation. The poor farmers that were destitute, and to have that on top of rebuilding, it was just a mammoth operation for everybody.
Now, tell us a bit more about this flying boardroom, the Bel Air Chev.
Well, there was a committee of six on that committee. Michael Hodgman, MLC, was secretary. Les Gabriel was another member. Les Baylett, Vern Ray, and Tom Wilson. And so they could fit easily into the Chev, and they had meetings at Latrobe, Devonport, Burnie, Wynyard, Scottsdale, Smithston, and so that's how it became christened the Flying Boardroom.
And what happened to the Flying Boardroom, do you know?
I see a similar one around from time to time, and I'd love to pull the person up at some stage. It's got special interest plates on it.
Could be still around, you don't know.
It could be. It could be, Tony, yeah. That's right.
Were you a farmer yourself?
Yes, I was. Doing sheep and cattle, and then went into poppies, and head of the Poppy Growers Association for a few years. Tony, yes.
And you turned 80 this year, same year as the Country Hour. What are your memories of the Country Hour, apart from helping out in the fires?
Well, didn't have any alternative but listen to the Country Hour as far as my father was concerned, as we've heard from so many people. And it was always a quiet time, and it still is today a great means of keeping the older farmers, retired farmers, informed with what is happening around the countryside, and it still serves a very useful purpose, and we're very grateful for that.
Yeah, retired 80-year-old farmer Lindley Chopping with his thoughts on the Country Hour and the role it played back in 1967 with the bushfires, helping to get much-needed hay to desperate farmers affected by the fires. More nostalgia for you in just a moment.
Kylie Baxter.
Get the most up-to-date travel tips for your afternoon commute. Avoid the jam and stay updated with the news as you cruise.
Kylie Baxter, back today from 4 p.m. on ABC Radio Hobart.
Keeping you updated every day. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Now, we can't talk about the early years of the Country Hour without talking about Blue Hills.
She didn't think you looked well, Davey.
That's not because I'm sick, it's because I'm old.
At 1 p.m, people would switch on the radio and would even take the phone off the hook to listen to the latest 15-minute episode of the popular radio serial.
Rose! What's happened?
Has Uncle Ed seen you yet?
No, not yet.
He's going to rock on his pins.
What an expression!
Hello, I'm Annie Brown, and this year the Country Hour marks 80 years since it first went to air on ABC Radio on December 3rd, 1945. Blue Hills is a beloved part of the ABC Radio history, starting in 1949 and going all the way until 1976. That's 27 years on air and a total of 5,795 episodes, all written by Gwen Meredith.
We've had drama, certainly, but I've always tried also to have some comedy. I don't mean slapstick, we've had a bit of slapstick too, but humour. I think this is most essential. I think people want to laugh.
Of the letters that I saw, it seemed to me at least 95%, possibly even more, were from women. Did you find that you were writing for women mostly?
I've never done this especially because I know, although some of them won't admit it, that the men come in for lunch too. to hear it. I was only speaking to someone locally here last night, and they said to me, I don't know what my uncle's going to do. He's trained a dog especially to bring in the cows so that he can get home to listen to it.
Gwen Meredith was first commissioned by the ABC to write a serial called The Lawsons, and Blue Hills came after that. Blue Hills focuses on families who reside in a typical Australian country town. However, Gwen Meredith wasn't actually from a farming family. She grew up in Sydney.
When I first began the Lawsons, it was a country family and I was not a country girl. The agricultural department arranged for me to go and stay on a property. They must have been appalled, of course, to think that I was going to write a story about a country family because they must have realised how ignorant I was. But, of course, one learns.
To get the details right, head of the rural department at the time, John Douglas, used to write to Gwen Meredith with some notes about how farming was being depicted.
Dear Miss Meredith, it's too early to plant sweet corn in your district. You'll have to let it go until about November when all frosts are over. Dear Miss Meredith, we enjoyed very much your motor car accident. About 6 weeks after shearing, the sheep should be dipped for lice. You might deal with this dipping over about 3 episodes.
But Blue Hills wasn't just about what crops were in season or when to dip your sheep. It covered lots of issues.
Rose and Granny have come into Wagga to buy engagement gifts for Anne. While there, they see a dress in a window which Granny tells Rose she should buy, partly as it will help build her own self-esteem and partly because it's time she took a stand against Ed's domineering attitude towards her.
Granny, I've decided. If you'll lend me the money, I'll buy it.
Oh, I'm delighted to hear it. Delighted. Get in and drive back to the shop at once. Be a downright tragedy if they sold it now, before you get there.
Well, they're keeping it for me.
Excellent. It's certainly coming on, Rose. I've hopes for you.
I'm afraid that isn't what Ed'll say.
Probably not. But come along. There are two people in every marriage. Ed seems to have overlooked that. It'll be as well to remind him.
That's an excerpt from Blue Hills, a radio serial that was broadcast during the Country Hour between 1949 and 1976.
Yes. I bet you remember.
Celebrating 80 years of rural stories on the Country Hour, I'm Annie Brown.
Just like yesterday, I bet you remember it. Blue Hills. 1949 to 1976 in association with the Country Hour. Well, let's get to livestock now. In Campbelltown Showground will be a hive of activity this afternoon with the annual Merino Ram Sale. Stud Merino Breeders Association of Tasmania President Frank Chester says he's expecting a couple of hundred people to attend today's sale from one.
We've got our annual Merino Ram Sale and it's our 10th one. So
pretty special.
Small milestone. Yeah, so no, hopefully it'll all go pretty well.
Not quite the 80th birthday of the Country Hour, but still a decade. Tell us about the Stud Merino Breeders Association.
Well, they put on this day 10 years ago. Damien Meeburn, one of the class in the state, decided to have the ram sale. You know, I thought it would be a good idea, and the Stud Merino Breeders got behind it, and, yeah, that's how we've ended up where we are now.
How many members have you got?
I reckon there'd be roughly about 50 studs in the state, Tony.
And what about the rams, number of rams today?
There'll be 40 rams there, and I think there'll be 10 different studs taking rams for sale.
Okay. Is it sort of like a bit of a competition? Mine, my ram will get more money than yours?
Yeah, no, it's a bit... Oh, yeah, everyone likes to have a good sale, that's for sure.
Any stars of the show that look like getting some good money?
No, I haven't seen any of the other sheep yet, but I've heard there's some good sheep coming. So I'd say there'll be, you know, the odd ram will make fairly good money. It won't be like all the sales. I don't think it's going to be over expensive, but, yeah, no, I think it'll be a good buying opportunity.
And it's a chance for everyone to get together. You think most of them will come along and say good day?
Yeah, no, it's turned into quite a big turnout. Now, you know, there's probably a couple of hundred people turning, a lot of them just come to have a look and have a bit of a chat, and we've got refreshments afterwards. And so, yeah, that's just a good way of catching up. And it is a good way for people to have a look at a few different bloodlines.
And the Merino sheep, so important to Tasmania. Why is that so?
I think a lot of our countries, you know, especially the drier areas, are very suited to it. And it's just the flexibility of it. I think you've got the meat side, which is very strong at the moment, and you've got the wool as well, so you've got a few options, and you can use a terminal, and just looking forward, you know, the meat's going to be good for probably the next 3 or 4 years, and I think wool's going to be pretty solid too.
Now, Frank, you're at Campbelltown, you're at Camelford.
Yep, that's the name of our place.
Where'd the name Camelford come from?
I think it came from England. There's a little village in England called Camelford.
Okay.
Yeah, so I reckon that's where it originated.
Now, how many sheep have you got on the property?
About 9,000.
Oh, that many. How many rams have you got?
We keep about 20 ourselves and we have about 50 to sell.
And the conditions have been really strange, haven't they, yesterday compared to today?
Yep. No, we've had, you know, probably one of the windiest springs we've ever had, I reckon. And but we've been lucky. We 8 weeks ago it could have gone either way, but we've ended up with a pretty good spring, which has been good. But sort of south of Ross and the east coast has been a real, you know, it's been a pretty hard year for them.
So you've had enough feed?
Yeah, we've fed all through to the spring. You know, there was no autumn or, you know, very little winter rain, but we've actually ended up with a good spring, so, which is, we're very appreciative of. But, yeah, just feel for the blokes that haven't.
Yeah. And what about the lambing season? How did that go?
Yeah, I think we're about average. Yeah, and the lambs that are about, I don't know the reason, but all the lambs around here, you know, as good of lambs as we've had.
Really?
I think it's I think there must be a lot of, you know, the pasture contents. There'd been a lot of clover, so, you know, the ewes have done well, and so the lambs have done well.
Hard counting them, but how many did you estimate?
We probably ended up with about 4,500 lambs, I suppose.
And how are you going for water?
We're pretty right because we're on the Elizabeth River, so, you know, we're right as far as stock water goes. And I know the dam still, Lake Leak hasn't probably got another metre to go before that's full. But, yeah, there's enough there.
Okay. Well, good luck with the sale today. Hope it goes well.
Thanks, Tony, and thank you very much for taking interest in the sale.
Yeah, the president of the Stud Merino Breeders Association of Tasmania, Frank Chester, talking about the 10th Merino Ram sale today at Campbelltown, at least. Starts in around about 8 minutes from now, so some good bidding coming up. All right, time on a Friday afternoon to check what's happening with the livestock markets in general. Say good day to Richard Bailey. How are you, Richard?
Going well, Tony. Going well. We don't seem to be able to get rid of this wind, but anyway, that's the way it goes. But I think there's a bit of warmer weather on the way, isn't there?
Oh, it's a bit of mixture, actually. I think we're getting some snow on Sunday. So,
all right.
It's okay today, though. The wind caused havoc yesterday, so it's quietened down today. So hopefully it'll stay that way. And, maybe we're warm. We're just not getting warmth, are we? Enough.
No.
We get one
extraordinary
day,
you know. Extraordinary for this time of the year.
Yeah.
And, you know, looking at some of the forecasts in Victoria particularly, you know, they've had snow up in the Highlands and I think they had about 36 degrees in Western Victoria yesterday. So
yeah. There
you go.
Crazy. Mm. Okay, cattle markets, what's happening?
Pretty similar cattle markets right throughout Eastern Australia during the week. Your better butcher type yearling cattle anywhere from 440 to 520 cents a kilo, which is sort of where they've been for me for a while. A few grown steers and bullocks, 450 to 500 cents. Cow market, just depending where you went, cows. I saw some really top cows make up to 440 cents a kilo, but most of the averages are sitting around about that 400 cents a kilo thereabouts. So your better heavy cows, 390 to 440, and then your secondary cows, 320 to 380 cents a kilo. At our market on Tuesday, I thought although the big heavy cows came back in price, the lighter cows and leaner cows, I thought sold, compared to the others, sold exceptionally well. You know, not many cows under 300 cents, so pretty good there. I mean, obviously, it's all based on the US job. While they keep taking our lean beef, that market will, I suppose, continue.
Yeah. So next door cattle sale, when's that?
That's next Thursday at Piranha. Mm-hmm. The next week we've got a sale at Smithton on Monday and then we're back at Piranha Tuesday and then back at Piranha on Thursday, 11 o'clock start. Look like about 1,200 cattle there, so that'll be a good place to go and buy cattle. Just quickly before we leave cattle, yesterday sale at Mortlake, store cattle sale at Mortlake, they quoted a little bit cheaper but still very, very good. Most of the cattle are staying in Victoria at the moment, whereas over the last sort of 18 months they've been going into New South Wales and Queensland. So a bit of a change in dynamics there, but certainly very, very strong.
Okay, now lamb and sheep, what's happening there?
Okay, bigger numbers of lambs, particularly in Western Victoria. Hamilton over 2 days yarded over 60,000 lambs. Ballarat, I think, were about 28,000. Lesser numbers at Bendigo. The quality of the lambs, particularly at Hamilton, has been very, very good. And that market's held up pretty well, you know. 1,050 to 1,150 cents a kilo. When we got to Wagga yesterday, 38,000 lambs up there. And they said that the vast majority of the lambs were under 21 kilos. So it was a lot of store lambs. They're better lambs, although fractionally cheaper in places. You could run, they said they could run a line to 1,000 to 1,100 cents a kilo and you'd get just about all of them. So still pretty good money at this time of the year. Be interesting to see running into Christmas, Tony. It always happens where, you know, kill space is a bit harder to find, and from our point of view, some of the shipping, some of the guys don't want to be shipping, you know, right up to Christmas, etc. So be interesting to see what happens over the next couple of weeks. But you would think that we've got through the most of the lambs now at around that sort of 1,050 to 1,150 cents a kilo. You would think that that'll probably continue into the new year with any luck.
Yep, and mutton?
Mutton market's been very, very strong, has been now for some weeks. 750 to 800 cents a kilo, and in some markets over 800 cents. You know, the big numbers of medium weight sheep making anywhere from $150 to $200 a head, and you've got mutton, heavy mutton making over $300 a head. So extraordinary prices for sheep at this time of the year. I don't know what we're going to be like for numbers going forward with mutton. You know, I think that we killed a lot of sheep in Victoria last year. Just be interesting to see how many mutton we've got going forward over the next two or three months, I reckon.
Yeah. It was a pleasure during the week to meet your mate, Arlie, with a moon bird on. What a lovely bloke.
I heard that you've been catching up with him.
Yeah.
Tony, just before we leave for lambs and sheep, on Tuesday night on the screen at 7:30, 7,000 first and second cross lambs. That'll be a pretty good sale, that, I reckon. So that's nice and convenient for farmers too. 7:30 at night. So that'll be interesting.
He tells me he's going to buy some tomatoes from the supermarket because these tomatoes are pretty ordinary.
he hasn't told the rest of the community that. So.
Well, they all know now. All right, Richard, you have a great weekend.
Good on you, Tony.
Yeah, Richard Bailey back with us next Wednesday to check the latest Power Runner sale. Market to market, Judy Tierney tells us the country our unit produced the program. Judy remembers those days with great fondness, says happy anniversary. Thanks, Judy. Good to hear from you. Hi, Tony, from Dave from Loon. Congratulations and thanks to all the people involved with the country hour over the years. Special shout to Rose Grant, with whom I graduated in Ag Sciences. Kind regards. Thanks for that, Dave. Terrific. Okay, have a great weekend. We'll catch you after midday Monday.